Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, would COVID stimulus checks targeting low and moderate income families be more effective? But up front, Pennsylvania schools have not been normal since they were closed last March at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. 5 months into the new school year, less than 20% of the state schools are back to full-time in-person instruction. 43% of schools hold their classes entirely remotely, and the other 38% have a combination of the two. Administrators, teachers, and families of students that do have in-person classes have often found precautions, changes, and operations inside the schools confusing and inconsistent. That's according to our guest today, Penn Live journalist Wallace McKelvey, who recently wrote about what's going on inside Pennsylvania schools. Wallace McKelvey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
1 year into this pandemic, teachers and support staff say that they feel set adrift without a lifeline. That's a quote from your story. Why do they feel that way?
Well, the biggest thing right now is there's no clear enforcement mechanism. So if you roll back the tape to earlier in the pandemic, the Wolf administration had every school district sign what it called an attestation form. You know, that's a kind of jargon for basically the school saying, we agree to follow a bunch of mitigation strategies to make sure that our students and staff are safe from COVID-19 if we reopen in person. It's a form that they signed saying, we'll do the right thing, essentially. Unfortunately, because of a variety of issues I'm sure we'll get into, not every school has been completely successful at that. And some of these things include masking, sanitation, social distancing, and closely monitoring the spread of infection within the school community. And if they reach a certain threshold, that could mean the end of full-time classes for a period of time while they try to get a handle on that outbreak. The teachers and support staff that I talk to, some of them say they don't trust that their school districts are doing the right thing, that they're following the mitigation strategies that they agreed to. And when they run into a problem like that, they feel like there's no one there to support them. Their complaints, according to them, have not been followed up by any kind of state investigation, and that it completely falls on the schools themselves, which understandably have an incentive not to admit fault.
There's a lot there that we are going to get to. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Maybe you have some of your own experiences to talk about as well. So, Wallace, as you said, there's a lot there. But when you say there's no enforcement of what? What are schools supposed to be doing, and what aren't some of them doing?
So the Wolf administration put out these guidelines, which were informed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's own kind of set of guidelines. Some of the things, as I mentioned, are pretty common sense. You want to make sure that you're cleaning up properly, that they're using cleaning products that will kill the virus if it's on any kind of surface, and that they're doing this on a regular basis. And that if they do have an outbreak, that they're able to step up their cleaning, do a more intensive clean of areas where there were, known or suspected positive cases, people in these classrooms, in these spaces. This also includes making sure that, all the staff and the students are socially distant. What you might see in a classroom space is, whereas there might have been 25 or 30 students at one point, many of these schools have had to reduce, that space down to maybe 10 or 15 students and spread them out over a bigger area. You also, and this is another interesting part of my investigation, it has fallen to the schools themselves to actually track the virus. So this is something called contact tracing. I was actually on your program talking about this before.
I remember.
Where you are trying to figure out, like, so if one staff member tests positive, you have to immediately talk to that staff member and find out who their contacts were, who they might have spread coronavirus to. Now, in the early, kind of earlier in this process, the state had said, you know, we will do this contact tracing with the assistance of the schools. In practice, what's happening right now is the schools are, because of short staffing at the state level, the schools are having to do this entirely on their own, which of course raises some concerns among the teachers and support staff that I talk to, because the schools are having to, you know, tick off, we have one case, we have two cases, we have three cases. And there have been discrepancies where, you know, who counts as a case? You know, are we counting people who definitely were tested positive? But are we also counting people who are suspected to have COVID-19 because they either have symptoms or they came from the same household as someone who's a known positive within the same school community? So those are the kinds of things right now that these schools are responsible for and that they agreed to do.
Why contact tracing? And again, I want to get back to some of the other items, but contact tracing, why has it been left up to the schools to do their own contact tracing? And I wonder, the people in the schools, the staff that are actually doing this, are they trained to do it? I mean, why isn't the state doing this? I know in some counties have their own contact tracing, some medical groups have their own contact tracing, but why has it been left up to schools?
Because the state system is pretty drastically underfunded and understaffed. Right now, as of the week of January 17th to the 23rd, Department of Health was reporting that they had just over 1,500 contact tracers working statewide. These people who are tracking down, you know, the spread of COVID-19 across the state. That's for the entire state. You know, we're talking the entire population, closing in on 13 million people. We only have 1,500 contact tracers. And what that means in practice is that week, only about a quarter of new cases from reported just that week received an initial contact where they were contacted by a case investigator and asked this series of questions about who you might have been in close contact to and where you might have spread the disease. That is the bigger context, the statewide context. What that means is that the schools, you know, there's not enough staffing within the Department of Health for those contact tracers at the state level to be tracking every case that might come up in the school district. And that is why you have people like school nurses, principals, guidance counselors. I even heard of one anecdote of a secretary who has taken up the task of doing this contact tracing. And what that means is these individuals, many of whom are not trained, they have not gone through any training program for this whatsoever. Some of whom have no background in medicine, in healthcare, in public health. They are calling people. And sometimes, you know, I spoke to a nurse, a school nurse from a Lancaster County school. She said, you know, she had just gotten off the phone with someone, and she was the first person to inform somebody that, hey, you were in close contact with someone who is a known positive case of COVID-19. You should get tested right away. And that is problematic, you know, on a couple levels. It's for her, you know, she is medically trained. She's a medical professional. But some of the people doing this are not. That's problematic. Another problematic element here is, as you well know, there are a lot of people out there who, you know, this is a very sensitive issue. There's a real stigma behind being diagnosed or being exposed to COVID-19. And the people doing these contacts, you know, they know these parents, they know their children. And in some cases, you know, parents, when they get a call from the school doing this contact tracing work, sometimes they respond with hostility. Like, how do you know this? Why are you calling me? Now, I don't want to make too big a thing of this. This isn't every call that happens, but I'm just pointing out that this is a problematic system. And it's also work that's being left to the schools when the schools themselves are already overtaxed. They're already underfunded. They're already short-staffed even before COVID-19 came. And now they're being tasked with doing this extra work on top of all these other adaptations to the pandemic.
Well, so you also wrote that there are instances of staff members not wearing masks. I don't know about students, because I thought that, you know, when the new school year started and all kids above a certain age would be required to wear a mask, I thought that that had potential to be a real issue. I don't know about students not wearing masks. Parents not notifying the schools of known cases. What are some of the things that, I mean, even the basics that don't seem to be being followed here?
Yeah, essentially every problem that you could see out in the world, you know, out when you go grocery shopping, the schools are dealing with the same things. So you're right. Like, certainly with school children in general, it seems like they've done a great job so far. You know, kids are very malleable. They adapt to change. But there are certainly instances where a child, you know, may not be equipped to, you know, to keep a mask on for 7-8 hours a day, you know, and, you know, they want to play with their friends. You know, you reach a certain age. I know I experienced this when I was a kid. You know, you just want to bounce around, and that happens. Also, you know, sometimes I got several reports of school staff members, adults, you know, adults who probably should know better, who are skeptical of these COVID-19 mitigation strategies and don't want to wear a mask during the school day. And they'll wear it, you know, when someone's watching them, but they repeatedly take it off. They get too close. They do all the things that you might see out in the real world right now. The schools, you know, they, unfortunately, the schools have become kind of the where all the problems of our larger society get manifest. And so all those problems are there, and it's on the administrators and it's on individual school staff members to do all of this police work on top of the contact tracing, on top of their original job, which is to fully and properly educate our young people and make sure that they can compete in the job market.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking with an astronaut, someone who's going into space very soon. That will be coming up on tomorrow's program. Today, during this segment of today's program, we're speaking with PennLive journalist Wallace McKelvey. He recently investigated and wrote about the situation in Pennsylvania schools. Probably you can say that not all schools, but some schools, some of the challenges and the hurdles they're facing in in-person classes. And there's a lot going on there. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Wallace, you touched on this, but you write in your story that reopening is very resource intensive, and schools often don't have those resources. Talk about some of the resources they need, and how are they coming up with ways to pay for these things or actually implement some of these mitigation strategies.
Yeah, and that's also part of the reason why so many schools are still either doing a hybrid model or they're completely online, even now, even this far into the pandemic. A big factor is space. So as I mentioned earlier with a classroom, you might be forced to condense a class size from 30 students down to 15. One way that schools have adapted to this is a hybrid model where different cohorts of students arrive on different days of the week. In Middletown School District, one of the districts that I cover in the story, that was their solution. They bring in a different group of students for Monday and Wednesday versus Tuesday and Thursday. And that's how they're able to adapt to the to have this separation, physical separation between the students in class. You also have to step up more protective equipment for janitors. You have to have, in some cases, changes in the school layout, because I'm sure you've seen in some of the grocery stores, which not very many people follow at this point, but where you have lanes, aisles, that people, you know, this hallway is dedicated to people going in this direction versus that direction. That may be less important in a grocery store, but it is important at class change in a school, because you're talking many more students in a confined space at a specific time of the day. The way they fund this, I mean, to date, there's money funneling into the schools now through some of the aid that was passed at the federal level. But there are no guarantees, as many of the stakeholders have told me, and many of these schools have not received the funding they need to carry out all of these new requirements handed down to them via coronavirus. Ultimately, you know, what that means is doing more with less, which I'm sure anyone in any job field is familiar with. For example, the superintendent in Middletown, she's the one doing a lot of the contact tracing. And she told me that she does not work a 40-hour week. I mean, she didn't work a 40-hour week before coronavirus, and now she's working even longer. She keeps the spreadsheet of close contacts and positive cases herself, and she is the one interfacing with the Department of Health on many of these issues. So you have a lot of people working even harder. And at the end of the day, it's going to be on taxpayers, because a main source of funding for the schools is property taxes, which I don't know if we want to get into this, but this raises another point of liability.
Yeah, go ahead. Since you brought that up, liability will be a big issue, or could be a big issue here.
Yeah, every person I talk to, all the stakeholders, whether they be administrators or school boards, elected school boards, or staff members, raised this specter of liability. And this cuts in two directions. There's a reason we want to reopen these schools to begin with. All of the science tells us that students learn better in person with a physical teacher. They just do. You don't have nearly the same level of distraction that you do at home with, you know, flaky internet connections, adaptation to technology, all of that. And also, you know, remote learning disproportionately affects students with learning disabilities. And it disproportionately affects low-income students who may not have easy access to a computer, easy access to the internet, the things that middle-class families take for granted. And so in that context, you know, with the reopening, there's a good reason to reopen. On the other side, if the reopening is not handled well, or even ideally, if all of these mitigation strategies are not followed and there is a major outbreak in these schools, on the other side, they're opening themselves up to potential civil liability if someone becomes gravely ill or dies as a result of COVID-19 in that school district. Now, you would think most school districts have liability insurance. That is true. But a lot of those policies explicitly do not cover a pandemic. Or their insurance companies, there have been cases where insurance companies have sent letters out to these school boards and school administrators saying, oh, by the way, that liability insurance policy that you have for the district, it doesn't cover COVID. Just to let you know, that's not covered. And even if you do have insurance, the school district has insurance to cover this. There's always the specter of increased premiums if there is a major lawsuit. And we're already starting to see litigation specifically on the education side of things, where people are raising concerns about, you know, are we properly educating, especially special needs students? So you have two areas of liability. You have the education front, and then you have the public health front. And ultimately, like, a lot of these the stakeholders, the school boards, the administrators, they're really concerned that they might be fighting these cases in court for years to come. And we just, it's one of those things that they're looking outward to with apprehension.
Let's take a phone call from Amanda in Montoursville. Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question, what recourse do parents have? I have a student who has an IEP, and he's had no contact with his IEP teacher since he went through the school's online cyber program. I still want to support the teachers because, for the most part, they're meeting with their IEP students well beyond school hours. They've actually set appointments at 8 o'clock at night on their own time because they're so understaffed. But that doesn't help my child and a number of other parents in my district. Our children are falling behind. We don't know how else to help them.
Amanda.
And I have no idea who to talk to.
Yeah.
Amanda, my heart goes out to you.
Yeah, because, Amanda. You know.
Go ahead, Wells.
Yeah, this is a problem that I've heard a lot about. These IEPs, basically plans for education, that specifically in the context of children with developmental or learning disabilities, and the schools are having a tough time. Yes, because these plans were developed prior to COVID-19, and these are the students who are most in need of being in person with the attention of a person, of a teacher, and an aide potentially. What I would suggest to you, first of all, and I imagine you've already done this, you know that saying, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I know it's tough, but be in constant contact with your administrators, your principals, your guidance counselors, your teachers. They're, unfortunately, they are stretched thin, but you know, your first goal is to be an advocate for your son or daughter. That's one level. The next level up is be the squeaky wheel for the school board, because the school board, they're elected officials. Ultimately, they're accountable directly to the people who live in that school district. And yes, the school board themselves, they're also stretched thin. You know, you have to understand that they're dealing with budget constraints. They're also dealing with the pressure not to raise taxes. But show up to some of these virtual meetings, express your concern directly to them, and, you know, be respectful, but be firm. You know, be an advocate with these people. They will listen to you. And then the next level up beyond that is make yourself heard to your local lawmaker, the people in the state house, and send letters to the Department of Education, send letters to the governor's office, be an advocate for yourself, because right now we're entering budget season, which I'm not going to get into all that that entails, but this is a critical time for funding on every possible program that the state has oversight over. So right now you have more power than you think you do. Be the squeaky wheel, advocate for yourself, and ultimately the final recourse could be in the courts. I don't know of specific cases that I could direct you to, because in some ways it might depend on the district. But usually the last resort is a civil case. Google, there are a couple that I know are kind of percolating in Pennsylvania that maybe they haven't been filed yet, but people are looking for cases to represent. You may not want to do that, but if all else fails, that's something that you could look to the courts.
Amanda, thank you very much for your phone call. We did have a question, and I wanted to make sure we had some context here, Wallace. IEP, we had listeners asking about that. What's that stand for?
Yeah.
Independent education program.
Full disclosure, I am not an expert when it comes to IEP. I only know about it in the context of this reporting. But essentially, it's a plan that is formulated and very often for students with kind of different kinds of disabilities. So, students who have developmental disabilities, learning disabilities, and it's usually funneling more intensive resources to those students to make sure that they are have an equal opportunity to be educated at the same level as their peers who don't have the same disabilities.
And it stands for Individualized Educational Program. Another email from a listener. I'm not going to mention the school district because I'm not absolutely sure this is the case. I don't know this for a fact. But the families are required to provide masks for children attending school in person. Additionally, if all the children would attend school in person, the decision was that social distancing would just not happen. This is another example of how school funding needs to be reformed to level the playing field. The families of lower-income households are more likely to need in-person schooling, but the lower-income households have to provide their own safety equipment and possibly suffer health consequences of no social distancing. This goes back to what you were talking about earlier and goes back to the larger issue of school funding and inadequate and inequality when it comes to school funding in some of our school districts.
Yeah, and there are some schools that really physically they're not going to be able to reopen full person in class. They're just not, because they don't have the space. This is especially true of rural districts and lower income districts where they already had large class sizes. If you don't have the physical space to separate students, it's not feasible to reopen.
You mentioned in your story that staff, sometimes they're getting mixed signals and that they're hesitant to report protocols not being followed. Why?
Yeah, well, and part of this is the nature of the beast. The one real big example that stands out to me is in Middletown, the superintendent there, Lori Suski, in December, she called the Department of Health for guidance when she had two cases of COVID within the same household. One of them had a definitive positive test. The other one was a suspected case because they had close interactions. Like, it's pretty obvious that that person was exposed to COVID. She called and asked, okay, should I count one case, two cases? And if she counted both of them, that meant that she would immediately have to close the school because of the threshold set by the Wolf administration. She was told, no, just count the one confirmed case with a positive test. So that school stayed open. The next month in January, she had a similar situation come up and she called the state. She got a completely different answer. Yes, you should count the suspected case. And so in that case, the school closed. And that's, you can find examples of that all over the place. And that's not entirely the state's fault, because as we learn more things about this disease, the guidelines will change. But there's so much confusion and there's so much responsibility that we're leaving to the schools that if that superintendent had not called back, had she just gone with the guidance from December, that school would have remained open and people would have been at risk.
The state has left it up to local districts to make their own plans. But as you just described, sometimes the schools feel like they're not getting direction from the state, and there is that kind of confusion. Basically, what you described in your article is there's a lot of uncertainty and confusion around this.
Yes. Yeah. And the biggest thing that the teachers, the other support staff, and their representatives in the union, what they're asking for is more enforcement teeth. At the end of the day, the thing that would be most helpful right now is if the Department of Education and the Department of Health had a clearer path when someone has a complaint about a district and a concern that a district is not following these guidelines, that they have someone who is an unbiased outside observer who can come in and investigate. And right now, you know, a lot of the people that I've talked to, a bunch of these teachers and support staff, they say they filed complaints with state officials, but that those complaints were ignored. No one ever followed up with them. No, they never got a call back to say, hey, we're looking into this, or hey, we looked into this and we decided it wasn't an issue and here's why. Department of Education, they told me in the course of my reporting that they received 27 complaints. And that those complaints, according to them, did not merit any follow-up action. But they didn't go into detail about the process of how they arrived at that conclusion, whether there was like an intense investigation or whether they just punted them back to the school board.
Mm. We're almost out of time, Wallace. There's so much information. We'll have a link to your story if someone didn't get an opportunity to read it on Penn Live, a link on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. But just a couple things in parting. Bus drivers say it's impossible to enforce social distancing and mask wearing. Substitute teachers are scarce, especially those substituting in a subject they usually teach. The Centers for Disease Control recommended last week that schools open as soon as possible if they can. There's a lot to think about here. So bottom line, what did you take away? What should the people of Pennsylvania take away from your investigation, what you found?
It's important to stay engaged. If you are a parent or a caregiver, and or if you are a teacher or a family of a teacher, come to these school board meetings. Have your voice heard. Speak out publicly. Talk to your administrators. And also talk to the people at the state level. You know, we often think, well, one voice can't change anything. But as I said to the one to Amanda, the caller, we're about to head into budget season. This is when lawmakers and the governor's administration, when they're really paying attention. Squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Penn Live journalist Wallace McKelvey. Wallace, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. President Joe Biden has proposed a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package that would include $1,400 stimulus checks to most Americans. 10 Republican senators have countered with a proposal that would cost about a third of Biden's plan and would send $1,000 in stimulus to most households. Some are asking if the stimulus money would be more effective if it was targeted to low and moderate income families. Washington Post columnist Heather Long recently wrote about scaled-down stimulus payments. She appears on today's Smart Talk. Heather Long is a Washington Post economics correspondent before joining the Post. She was a senior economics reporter at CNN and a columnist and deputy editor at the Patriot News in Harrisburg. Heather, always good to talk to you. President Biden met with Republican senators yesterday. Your column was written before the Republican proposal came out. Some people you've talked with said the stimulus should be more targeted. Why?
Well, obviously money doesn't grow on trees and we only have so much of it. But the idea here, I think most Americans agree that in this pandemic, we need to help people who lost a job through no fault of their own and are really suffering right now. Nobody likes to see these long lines at the food banks. Nobody wants to see people evicted in the middle of a pandemic. But when you look at who really needs this money, who still hasn't been able to get back to work, it is overwhelmingly low-wage workers. We're talking about people who earn $40,000 or less. We know that those people, the unemployment rate in that low-wage category is still around 20%, depression-like levels. They are hurting, whereas most of the wealthier Americans have fully recovered. The other thing that I wrote about is if we look at the spending, we now just have another round of stimulus checks that went out in January. If you just look at spending, who spent those right away versus saved them, there's basically a really clear cutoff line where people earning under $75,000, so these are your low-wage restaurant worker types, they spent the money right away, usually at grocery stores, gas stations, basic necessities. People over that $75,000 threshold, by and large, saved the money.
You know, it's kind of ironic because before this pandemic and the recession that we're in now, you would often hear people being encouraged to save money. But in this case, you want people to spend money. And that brings up a point. Just to be clear, there are two different terms being used when we're talking about this. One is stimulus, which would mean stimulating the economy, as opposed to COVID relief. Do those two terms matter in the long run?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Scott. So we're trying to do a little bit of both in this. We're trying to give relief to the people who've lost their job and who literally need that money in order to buy food, make their car payments, make their rent payments. But we're also trying to do a little bit of a double dip. When those folks who get that money and who desperately need it, when they go out and spend it right away, that also helps those struggling corner stores that were worried about closing. It helps keep landlords who haven't been paid for months, give them some money. So the money, that's what we're talking about in stimulating the economy. So we're trying to do a little bit of both here, but I would say the primary reason we're doing this is for relief, to be that Band-Aid so we can help these people survive until they can hopefully get back to work this summer after we get vaccines out.
If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment to Heather Long of The Washington Post, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Heather, in your column, you spoke with several economists, several people who talked about they had statistics to back it up, but then talked about why they felt that a more targeted stimulus plan would make more sense. But I want to go back to some of the people that you talked to and some of those statistics, some of the anecdotal evidence that they have that even the last stimulus package, those checks that went out, how they were used. One in particular that stuck out to me was $200 billion went to people making over $75,000 a year, but only 7% of that, $15 billion, was actually spent by those people. I mean, is that a good example of why a targeted plan would make more sense?
Well, that's what people are arguing. I totally agree with you, your point earlier, that usually saving is a good thing and we want to encourage people to save. And many people are holding on to that money in case things get rough for them this spring or they want to pay down debts. That is not a bad thing to do with the money. But again, I think most people, when they look at where we are in this crisis, they want this money to be more targeted towards the people who truly need it, in order to put food on the table and keep a roof over their head. And that population, when you look at how that's been spent, that population is people of lower middle class means, so people who are well under the $75,000 a year threshold. And that's why I think that becomes such an important cutoff. The other interesting thing that I found when I was doing this research is it was really different how the first stimulus check payments, the ones that came out last spring, how they were spent versus the January ones, those $600 ones that just went out in the last few weeks. In the spring, of course, we all remember how horrible March and April were with so much of the economy closed, so much fear of the virus. In that period, we saw much more job loss across the income spectrum, and we saw much more spending when these stimulus checks came out across the income spectrum. There was a clear boost in spending from middle-class folks in addition to people who are more moderate or lower income. We did not see that after the $600 payments came out, and a big reason for that is some of the economy has reopened. Some of the economy has improved. We know that about half of the 20 million people who lost their jobs last March and April have gotten back to work. The bulk of those people who've gone back to work are people who are more middle class. But the folks who are still struggling are those lower income people. And that's the argument to really target the aid towards those people who are still out of work and who we know desperately need this money.
Heather, one of the things you found and you wrote about in your column is that there are some who feel that expanding unemployment benefits would actually be more of a help than at the stimulus checks going out to those making over a certain amount of money, like $75,000 and up.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I hear this a lot. And certainly that is why we have unemployment insurance, to help the people who have lost their jobs in the last stimulus package. I call it stimulus. We could also call it relief package, as you pointed out, that was passed over the holidays. We did increase the amount of unemployment money. We bumped it up another $300 through March. So that's definitely been a help to those unemployed. But there's a big but here. And that is, I've written about this too, a lot of people who lost their jobs did not qualify for unemployment or had some sort of hiccup in the process. It's been a really daunting process. And by the Washington Post calculation that I did last month, over a million people are still waiting for their first unemployment payment. Some of them have been unemployed who I talked to, like a bartender in Atlanta who lost his job in March of last year and did not receive any unemployment money until the Washington Post inquired about his case shortly after Christmas. So that's why we need these stimulus checks as a supplement to that unemployment. Another common case that I hear is people who are back to work. So maybe they no longer qualify for unemployment, but they are not getting nearly as many hours, or they have had to take a pay cut. I think about a woman I spoke to in New Orleans named Allie, who cleaned homes. She used to, before the pandemic, clean a home for $200 for the home. Now she does it for $75, less than half of what she was making before. So yes, she, quote, has a job again, but it is so much lower paid. She cannot make all of her bills right now. And so that's why we need the stimulus checks for these vulnerable population, because just getting a job back right now is not sufficient for many people.
A comment from a listener says the stimulus proposal was one of the strongest arguments for Keynesian spending. Any targeting, though, should be means tested. Your thoughts on whether there would be means, and that basically what he's talking about is if someone has, you have to prove what your income level is before you get a certain amount of money.
Yeah. So basically what this person's arguing is what we've been talking about, the idea that it should be more targeted. The income threshold should probably be lower than what it was in the spring or in the January round. Let me add two thoughts to that quickly. One is, I hear from a lot of people who say, you know, I had pretty good earnings in 2018 and 2019 before the pandemic. Then I lost my job, and now I have, you know, basically earned nothing last year except maybe unemployment money. Under this proposal from Republicans, or what I'm talking about, this more targeted proposal, that person might not get a check. Maybe they earned, you know, $80,000 before the crisis. Here's the difference. Sitting here in February 2020, 2021, we now have 2020 tax data. We have the ability to actually know who lost income in 2020 during the crisis. And if we can base this next round of stimulus payments on the 2020 income, which we were not able to do before, we had to use 2018 or 2019, which was a really rough guess. Then I think there's more of a case to target the payments because we know who actually was hurting last year.
This is an age-old debate that has been going on, but part of the president's stimulus plan, that $1.9 trillion, is raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And arguments will go on whether that would stimulate the economy or would cost jobs. As I said, an age-old debate, but what about this as part of the stimulus package?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll make two thoughts on that. From an economic point of view, the overwhelming evidence is that we lose few jobs or no jobs by raising the minimum wage to a $15 an hour. So play parts of the country that have done it. They compare what happened in those cities or states versus neighboring cities or states. And by and large, there's been little to no job loss. That said, you ask another important question, which is, should $15 be part of a relief or stimulus package? That, I think, is a more valid argument. That's more of a political question. I will say it is likely, if they have to pass this legislation through the reconciliation process, which is the ability for Democrat only in the Senate to pass it, and that's one of the options Biden has, so not to get any Republican votes. If you do the reconciliation process, it's kind of technical, but it is unlikely the $15 minimum wage would survive that process because it's supposed to be only for budget items, and a $15 minimum wage is not a budget item. So I think it will not survive the stimulus negotiation.
And there's also the assumption that 50 Democrats plus Vice President Kamala Harris would support a $15 minimum wage as part of this, and that's not guaranteed either. I mean, today the way we're divided politically, there are a lot of times we're all Democrats, all Republicans, but there are some Democrats in states that are like, okay, I don't know whether this fits under the reconciliation project process for one thing. That's just it. So where we stand right now, just your observations, we don't know a whole lot that came out of the meeting yesterday between the president and the Republican senators. How do you see what's going on and how long it will be before we have some kind of decisions made on the stimulus or relief packages?
Yeah, great questions, Scott. Basically, the next week is critical. President Biden has said that speed is the most important thing to him, getting this bill passed and getting the money out quickly. And so that doesn't leave a lot of time. Right now, the Republican proposal overall is $600 billion. Biden's proposal is $1.9 trillion. That's a big difference. Is there a path to compromise? Yes, but could they really get it done in the next 2 weeks? That's what the White House is testing the waters on with that meeting last night and with what the talks that are going to go on this week. Basically, this is a tricky political decision for Biden. He's talked about unity. Does he take he could probably get the Republicans to about a $1 trillion package, half of what he wants. Does he take that in the spirit of unity, or does he say, forget it, I just want to do everything that I want to do and do the Democrat-only process, that reconciliation process? He's going to have to make that decision very soon. The downside to doing reconciliation, obviously, there's no Republican votes. But the other thing is, you only get two chances to do that this year. He's got an ambitious agenda. He wants to take action on climate change, on infrastructure, on many other, possibly this $15 minimum wage. In order to do that, he's only got two chances. So he would effectively, if he has to go Democrat only now on this relief proposal, that means he can only do one more big thing this year.
Heather Long is Washington Post economics correspondent. And of course, many central Pennsylvanians know her as a columnist and deputy editor at the Patriot News in Harrisburg. Heather, always nice talking with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Happy Friday.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.